It was 9 o'clock at night, and his family was in bed. Michael Weekman was just about to turn in himself when he heard a sharp rapping on the front door of his little farmhouse in Hydesville, just outside Rochester, New York. So he went to the door to see who was knocking at bedtime, and there was no one there. So he closed the door and started to make his way to bed once more. But he hadn't gotten far from the door when the rapping came again. He rushed to the door and threw it open. But again, no one there. He went out into the street and looked around the house. No one. This was particularly eerie in a farming community where there's a lot of open space and not many places to hide. So this time, when he went back in the house, he stayed by the door with his hand on the latch and waited to see if the knock would come once more. And the rapping came yet again. Michael Weekman sprang into the street for the second time that night, but no person was to be seen anywhere in the vicinity. The Weekmans lived in the little Hydesville farmhouse for part of 1846 and 1847. Later that year, Mr. Weekman and his family moved away for reasons having nothing to do with the strange raps, which only repeated once more for his 8-year-old daughter, and the house was occupied by a John Fox and his family. They'd been staying in the house for about 4 months when the strange rapping returned. Except the sound was no longer coming from the front door, but rather inside the house. It sounded like someone was moving chairs or knocking on the floor. John and his family did a thorough search of the whole house, but they couldn't find any source for the strange sounds. This was particularly baffling in the period before indoor plumbing, electricity, and all the other household things that tend to go bump in the night.
Am I the only one that, when they're hearing this, just imagines that they're, like, running through their house trying to, like, listening to, like, Biggie Smalls rapping in the walls, and they're like, we have to find him. We can't listen to Big Papa one more time.
He's never behind the door.
Yeah, they just, like, don't know where he is. He's, like, running around, and they're like, stop the rapping.
My name is Rob Thompson. I am the Supreme Hierophant of the Secret Order of Alchemical Actors. I am here, as usual, with our Grand Master of Ceremonies, Olivia Litteral, back in the studio.
Hey, guys.
Hey-o. We've got three folks joining us in discussion today. Olivia's sister, Brianna, is back with us. Welcome back, Brianna.
Hello.
Hello. Jacob Wheatley.
Hi, I am the rapping behind the door. You're welcome.
Oh, not Biggie?
No, it's me still rapping, though.
If anyone's hearing a gentle rapping...
It's me.
It's just Jacob in your house, knocking on the door.
He'll leave after, like, a week.
And Savannah Verrett.
Hello, everyone.
You don't want to threaten our listeners?
No.
With invading their homes, knocking on the... Okay.
Am I the only one with that?
I can't rap,
Let's get to our... Get to our traditional vow here. We, the members of the Secret Order of Alchemical Actors, do solemnly commit ourselves to a full and honest telling of the history of the occult as far as we know it. On the evening of March 31st, just as everyone was crawling into bed, the sounds resumed. The Fox girls, Kate and Margaret, were in the bed across the room from their parents. This is the 19th century. We all slept in one room. We get conflicting reports on the girls' ages, but at least one, if not both of them, were in their adolescence. Kate, the younger one, was between the ages of 9 and 11. Margaret was between 12 and 15.
Horrible age.
For everybody?
Oh, yeah.
They started to mimic the taps by snapping their fingers, and the taps mimicked them in turn. There's a minor controversy in this pretty significant moment when the girls first communicated with the taps. According to many reports, Kate said to the taps, "Mr. Splitfoot, do as I do."
What?
Splitfoot?
All right, so seems pretty harmless to some of our listeners, but I think the surprise we're hearing in this crowd is what? Why are you guys shocked?
The name Splitfoot?
Yeah,
that
sounds
creepy
to me. I thought
of Switchfoot, not gonna lie.
You shouldn't.
The band.
No, it's not the band Switchfoot. No. Also,
also in the walls.
Biggie Smalls not involved.
Oh,
why? So, what bells are going off with Mr. Splitfoot?
It literally looks in my head as a man with just like cuts in between his feet.
You should name it.
Oh.
You don't name things. Don't address or name things.
Well, that too, from a perspective of a spiritualist.
So, yeah. Subsequent critics of psychic spiritualism argue that this first moment, this first invocation, was of the devil. Because he has a split cloven hoof.
Okay, yeah.
That makes sense.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, I was getting there. Split foot.
Or some kind of demon.
Okay, that makes sense.
So, John, the father, asked the taps to count to 10, and they did. John tells us he started then to talk to the taps. John?
I then asked if it was a spirit, and if it was, to manifest it by two sounds. I then asked if it was an injured spirit to give me the sound, and I heard the rapping distinctly. I then asked if it was injured in this house, and it manifested it by the noise.
John discovered that the spirit belonged to a 31-year-old man with a family of five. He was a single parent, his wife having died 2 years earlier. Pretty normal for the time period, because she had all those kids.
I was about to say, yeah. Five kids?
Childbirth is
good.
Dangerous. Yeah, she got lucky.
Yeah.
Mrs. Fox asked if the taps would sound for the neighbors and invited Mrs. Redfield over to hear them. Mrs. Redfield started questioning the spirit, and then the Dooslers, the Hydes, and the Jewels all joined the party.
The Dooslers?
No. The Dooslers. The Doislers?
That's unfortunate.
D-U-E slurs.
The Dooslers now.
The Dooslers.
The Doolsers.
Mr. Fox and Mr. Redfield, just the fathers, stayed overnight at the house, but Mrs. Fox and her daughters stayed with the neighbors. News spread of the strange haunting of the Fox house, and people began to flock there from the surrounding area over the next couple of days, because no Netflix. Asking yes or no questions, the amateur investigators discovered that this 31-year-old man was actually a peddler who had been murdered in the house and buried in the cellar. Guess while he was going door to door.
That's rough.
It's like, would you like a vacuum cleaner? And they were like, those haven't been invented yet.
That seems like a mix up.
Yeah.
You went from being a man with a family and five children
to being buried.
A peddler?
You can't trust.
That was murder?
You can't trust people.
Well, it was his job. He peddled for a living.
They're still connected.
And then the party started to dig in the place where the spirits appeared to be rapping. The rapping was something like a vibration, like you might feel if thunder sounded outside your house.
Okay, but guys, I'm imagining a bunch of ghosts in a circle.
Oh. You okay? Ghosts in a circle.
Okay.
Rapping.
Again, like Biggie Smalls? Yeah. Having a rap battle. And then
one of them's beatboxing.
So, are we talking Biggie v. Tupac?
Yeah,
it's happening.
That is
exactly what I'm picturing.
Yeah.
And start digging in the middle of them. So, where they were digging, they struck water and they had to give up. Later, the name of this peddler would surface, Charles B. Rosma, R-O-S-M-A, and the searchers would discover traces of quicklime teeth and hair. This is much later in this story. Still later, they would turn up bones along with Mr. Rosma's peddler's case in the wall of the cellar. It's important to note here, and you'll want to remember this for later, that while Kate and Margaret were the first to communicate with the mysterious taps, they weren't the only ones. Neighbors from all over carried on conversations with the dead peddler Charles Rosma. This early account of the Hydesville rappings was published largely from the correspondence with the first witnesses compiled by a man named D.M. Dewey in 1850, sort of the authoritative source, the first historical witness of the Fox sisters. Although he himself wasn't necessarily there, he brought together all the sources on what happened. Dewey says that at a certain point, part of the Fox family left for Rochester, where Kate and Margaret's older sister, Leah, was living with her husband, and, quote, the rappings were then heard in both places, meaning both in the Hydesville house and now where the sisters were. So this is how we started to develop this idea that the sisters were somehow channeling the taps.
It may be here remarked that when the sounds first began to attract attention, and during the investigation at Hydesville, they were heard in the presence of any member of the Fox family. They were also distinctly and repeatedly heard by persons who were examining the house when every member of the family was absent.
So the sisters somehow mediated these tapping sounds, causing the spirits to manifest in this distinctly audible way. And Dewey's not exactly clear on how that all came about, that people started to say, oh, the sisters are mediating it, but it probably had something to do with the fact that the taps followed them to Rochester. Now, with spirits communicating in Rochester, we'd stretched beyond the haunting in Hydesville, and a whole crew of spirits were beginning to communicate with the sisters. The spirits directed Margaret, Kate, and their sister Leah, who was now getting in on the act because she claimed she had suddenly developed her own mediumistic powers, to channel these rappings and share the news of their communications with the world. Mm-hmm. So the spirits are saying, okay, go out and get famous and make us famous.
Question. Mm-hmm. Might be a dumb question. So wherever they were was where the rapping was at this point. Like, it wasn't like if they were in a different location, there was rapping. But then if while they were in a different location, there was still rapping in the original house.
For a while, there was rapping in the original house. Yeah. Even though
they weren't there.
Yeah. Okay. And that was right from the start.
Yeah.
But now we're getting to the point where we're mostly interested in the rapping that's attending them.
Right.
And now Sister Leah, who wasn't even involved in that initial Hydesville episode. Mm. There'll be explanations for that, mostly kind of a quasi-genetic explanation that the family has this trait, right, that's been passed down from generation to generation of channeling spirits. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's coming down the road. So, they hired out a hall, elected a committee to investigate their claims, and the committee couldn't make sense of what was happening. There's a lot of acknowledgement of a tactile jar that people would feel in the doors, the floorboards, or the bedposts. This is that feeling of thunder I talked about a moment ago. The sisters were becoming locally famous at this point and started giving seances for the fairly hefty sum of $1 or $5 for private sittings in Albany. You'll remember from the Emma Harding Britton episode, how much again was $5 in the 1850s, 1860s?
$100.
Yeah, about $100. Nice.
That's...
you
I remember.
On, like you were on a quiz show.
Wow.
Yeah. Really jumped on that one.
They also attracted the notice of some pretty angry and violent critics. A mob in West Troy, New York, tried to storm the house where Margaret was staying. Word got around about the assassination attempt because they were trying to kill her. Sorry, left that part out. Oh. And Mr. Boutin, Maggie's host, arranged for some men to guard her. The mob that was storming the house shot into the house and threw rocks through the windows, but Maggie survived the incident.
That's insane. Gosh.
It's a rough time.
War zone.
Yeah.
In this house.
Well, you have to bear in mind, in this period, like, the Mormons were run out of New York by angry mobs.
I thought you were going to say the Mormons were the ones coming out.
No, it wasn't the Mormons.
I was like, oh, no.
No, not the Mormons. Were well on their way to Utah at this point. And yeah. Joseph Smith, who founded the Mormon Church, was shot to death, leaving a prison. So when you were coming up with these new religious ideas or doing spooky things, people did not respond well.
That's not really that old news, though, you know?
People still don't respond to them. So this is all happening against the background of the Burned Over District, a particular region of western New York State that saw the emergence of an unusual number of new religious practices between 1800 and 1850, which includes the Mormons. Spiritualism was the tail end of a phenomenon that included the Second Great Awakening and the Mormons. And that brings us to today's very brief history.
A very brief history of the Burned Over District.
Yeah, flames and stuff.
Love fire.
Yeah, lit.
Western New York's religious fever began with the Second Great Awakening. People started gathering at outdoor camp meetings where conversion happened on a mass scale.
Mass scale.
Preachers like Charles Grandison Finney?
That's the guy.
Advocated for an active program of saving souls, and that salvation would come through direct spiritual inspiration rather than following doctrine. This focus on the personal in religion.
Yeah, the personal aspect is a personal conversion, a personal experience. How did you feel out in the woods?
Amen.
The personal in religion opened the door for two major new movements before spiritualism, which all got their start in the same region that the Fox sisters first heard their raps.
Yeah, we're becoming more and more interested in your personal psychology and your emotional engagement with religion. It's not enough to just go through the motions, right? You have to feel something. That's what these camp meetings are all about.
I've been to many of those.
Fun.
I bet we all. William Miller, a farmer living in northwestern New York, was inspired reading the book of Daniel.
Unto 2300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed.
Yes.
Ooh. Jesus, cleanse me.
What if Daniel didn't mean days, but years?
Ooh.
2300 years after Daniel.
That's the perfect
That would be 1843.
Daniel!
A cleansing.
Tomorrow.
Cleansing. The second coming of Christ.
The second. Oh, Jesus, blessed be.
That's Wicca.
That's Wiccan. I'm sorry.
The second coming of Christ will happen in 1843.
That would be cool.
Put that in my schedule.
I'm down.
Miller was a reluctant public speaker, but felt responsible for sharing his revelation. And as the predicted year drew closer and closer, he amassed around 50,000 followers. He set the date for the apocalypse to March 21st. When it didn't come, he recalculated and landed on October 22nd.
Yeah, and a lot of people just went along. They were like, oh yeah.
That sounds right.
It's hard to do that kind of math.
Right.
For over 2,300 years.
I mean, I couldn't do
okay.
It.
I can't count.
Anyone could have screwed that up. Let's go with October.
Well, nothing.
Yeah.
Many became disillusioned by Miller's failure, and he died in...
Twice in a row he failed. Yeah,
true. He died in relative obscurity in 1849. But a small movement, believing the foretold cleansing and consecration had happened in heaven and not on earth...
Yeah, we just didn't know that it happened.
Yeah.
But it happened.
Oh, geez.
Persisted and became the Seventh-day Adventists.
Yep, all over today.
Oh my gosh, mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen a church of them down...
Yeah.
The highway.
They're all over. They began as the Millerites. Fun fact.
In the small town of Palmyra?
Yep.
In Ontario County, New York, on September 23rd, 1823, Joseph Smith had a vision of the angel Moroni.
This is Savannah's favorite story.
A little too much.
Yeah, go ahead.
Moroni helped him to discover a collection of golden tablets buried in stone box in Manchester, New York. Smith translated the tablets from behind a screen because he was the only one allowed to see them.
Yeah, no one ever saw the tablets except for Joseph Smith.
I love this.
Weird. And to his friend Martin Harris, and the transcription was printed in 500 copies as the first Book of Mormon.
Right, Harris sat on the other side of the screen. Smith just sort of talked to him over the screen, and Harris busily scribbled
these
things
down.
That's how
I wrote all my essays.
Yeah, isn't it?
Huh.
Go on.
Oh, Smith wants to talk.
And it came to pass that the Lord commanded my father, even in a dream, that he should take his family and depart into the wilderness. And it came to pass that he was obedient unto the word of the Lord, wherefore he did as the Lord commanded him. And it came to pass that he departed into the wilderness.
Smith and his followers were run out of New York because of their eccentric beliefs derived from the book, including belief in Smith's prophetic authority and belief that direct personal revelation was superior to reason.
Right, it's kind of, you know how people love to say, oh boy, those Mormon beliefs are silly and they make musicals about it and stuff?
Yeah.
But here's the thing about Mormonism, they literally don't believe in rationality. They think that true revelation is non-rational.
Which is brilliant.
Yeah. So you can't argue with
yeah.
that.
Like, there's no way around that.
Yeah, they have had this direct revelation from God. So go ahead, argue all you want, make your musicals, make South Park episodes, knock yourself out. It doesn't matter. God told us so.
And I'm going to get my own planet.
Right.
And you can't say
right.
no.
So go ahead, argue with the Mormons, see how far it gets you.
After being driven from Jackson City, Missouri, Smith was imprisoned in Nauvoo?
Yeah, Nauvoo, Illinois.
Ooh,
yeah.
Illinois, a town he founded. Oh.
Yeah.
Because his new teachings on plural marriage and shot to death.
Yeah, he was shot. Yeah, he was in prison.
His teachings of shot to death.
Right, so.
The sentence was weird.
So
Sorry.
The deal is, he starts, as they're traveling, they're sort of forced out of New York by these angry mobs in the city, in western New York. And as they're traveling across, they stop and found a town. And he's like, oh, this is the place where Mormons should be forever and ever. And he's
right.
like, also, we should have lots of wives, including this 14-year-old girl. And the other Mormons are like, ooh, that makes us feel kind of weird a little bit. And then the people in Illinois are like, that also makes us feel kind of weird. Let's put him in jail for a little while and sort of think this through. And then...
And then he was shot to death attempting to escape.
Yeah.
The Mormons would go on to establish their city of Zion. In present-day Salt Lake City, Utah.
Yep, their second town. And that was then the Chosen Land.
Yeah.
Is that right? Is that the chosen?
The promised land.
The promised land.
Bible on the West Coast.
It has something to do with margarine. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. So direct revelation cuts right across all of these movements. In every case, Miller's doing his own direct interpretation of the Bible. Smith is receiving magic golden tablets from angels and doing his own interpretation of what religion is. And that sort of is pushing us closer and closer to a situation where now the Fox sisters can directly communicate with the spirits of the dead. They can mediate them. In every case, we're looking for this personal mediation of another worldly force. So
Smith and Miller are really priming us for spiritualist mediums.
And that's a brief history of the Burned Over District.
Hooray!
Thanks, everyone.
When the Fox sisters came to New York City in June of 1850, they met with Horace Greeley, the newspaper editor of the New York Tribune, one of the biggest newspapers of its day.
He just doesn't sound like a fun guy.
Well, he was a liberal dude.
His name is kind of gross.
Yeah.
He was briefly a congressman, but he wasn't popular with Congress.
I mean, because of his gross name.
Yeah.
That's... Well, actually, because he was busy doing exposés of all his fellow congressmen while he was in office.
I told you, this dude sounds like his name.
He ran as a presidential candidate again against Ulysses S. Grant's re-election in 1872, which is an election we'll hear about once more, because Victoria Woodhull ran as the first female presidential candidate that same year. And he championed the settlement of the American West in his newspaper and his politics, helping to popularize the phrase, "Go West, young man." Jacob just walked out the door.
I'm going
He's
west.
Going west.
He's going west. Greeley was an early, albeit reluctant, advocate for the Foxes. His wife had taken an interest after the death of their child, Picky, and Greeley invited the sisters to their house.
So Picky.
The
Picky.
Name Picky in the family.
Picky Why? Greeley, yeah.
These That's are the most bad. Unfortunate
She sounds
names.
Like
I think
a cartoon.
That was her nickname, so yeah, that wouldn't be
what
been
was,
her
What
given
would
name.
You get? How would you get...
Picked?
I don't know. I don't know.
What,
I,
what
I
name
they picked
is that derived
Her name
from?
Was Pickles.
I didn't write down her actual name. I'm hoping it was Pickles. Pickles Greeley.
That's a beautiful name.
There, along with much that seemed trivial, unsatisfactory, and unlike what might naturally be expected from the land of souls, I received some responses to my questions of a very remarkable character, evincing knowledge of occurrences no one could well have been cognizant.
Greeley found the business of waiting around for spirits to manifest, who sometimes didn't manifest at all, a dull avenue of investigation, and he didn't pursue it much. Although he tended to believe that there were among the frauds and fakers some genuine mediums, including the Fox sisters, Greeley believed that the sisters should be given a proper education and offered to pay to send them both to school. Their older sister, Leah, did not want to put an end to the girl's career, which by all accounts was in an upward trajectory, so she let the younger sister, Katie, go while taking the older Margaret on to perform in Philadelphia. So Leah's basically seeing a cash cow situation here, and Greeley is like, boy, these are like teenage girls. Could we just not turn them into a freak show?
Are they still the same age at this point?
Well, we're a couple years down the road
just
now.
Just a couple?
Yeah, but we're still in, you know, late teens, mid to late teens.
Oh, yikes.
So for all the reasons that we're talking about here, Leah is a sort of divisive figure in the story of the Fox Girls. It seems suspicious that she would develop mediumistic powers just like her sisters, but she made the case, as I was mentioning earlier, that mediumship was a hereditary trait among the Fox family. Spiritualists tended to see Leah as a positive figure, though, advancing the cause. Emma Harding Britton, for example, who you remember from our last series on the American occult, called Leah the best test, rapping, and physical medium I ever met, which is a pretty good endorsement from the historian of American spiritualism, as well as the kindest and most noble-hearted of women.
Oh, wow. That's quite...
Brianna's not buying any of this.
I'm not.
She held general receptions in the winter evenings at her home in New York, and her guests would gather around the old Rochester dinner table, which she brought from the Fox farmhouse. Yeah, had
this
some
is so bougie.
Little historical appeal. Non-spiritualists tended to see her as mercenary and self-promoting, taking advantage of Maggie in order to keep the rapping money train rolling. All right.
Is that an album name?
I know, it
the rapping
like
money
it.
Tree rolling?
I can't help but
train.
Think
train? Yeah. Sorry.
They're all actually just having major rap battles. Like, that's all they're doing.
So now you see psychic mediums having rap battles.
Yes.
With ghosts.
Yes.
Wow. I would pay so much money to see that as a show in Las Vegas.
I would pay more than $5 to see that.
All right, so back to the Fox sisters. Katie's off to school, and the story focuses in on Maggie, who's now giving seances at the Union Hotel in Philadelphia, and the year is now 1852. So we've added 4 years. Maggie's, you know, neighborhood of 17 to 19 years old, give or take. A gentleman by the name of, now this is really fascinating stuff, a gentleman by the name of Elisha Kent Kane.
Better name. Such
That's
a cooler
really
name.
That's a good name.
And wait till you hear about him. Attends one of these seances with Maggie, and he is instantly smitten with her.
Ooh.
They begin exchanging notes. He calls on her.
Oh!
And they take long carriage rides around the city with his cousin.
Oh, okay.
H.J. Patterson.
Oh, that was pretty hot stuff. I don't know what you're talking
cousin?
About. Yeah, you have to have your guardian.
You have to have an escort. This is not the Tinder days. You don't just show up.
He was looking out the window.
Can you imagine a Tinder representative coming to your dates?
I feel like it'd be a lot safer.
Tinder would have to. They really should.
It really should be a thing.
I want to apply for that job. I want to be the Tinder representative on your date.
I want Rob to be my Tinder representative.
Yes, I'll pay you royalties for every date that I go on. This causes a minor scandal among Philadelphia's smarter set because Kane is a member of their ranks. He's a rich dude. Mm-hmm. He's got money and a respectable family name, as Olivia has already pointed out.
I told you.
And all the privilege that comes with all that jazz. Maggie is a country girl, right? Coming from Hydesville, New York, where her parents owned a farm.
Yeah.
And she's at the front of a pop culture craze, whose name is regularly in all the papers. So she's tantamount to like a living, breathing scandal. In the 19th century, I don't know if this has changed. I've never been rich and don't ever plan to be, although
$5
I'm sure this podcast will be bringing in all kinds of coin for
us. Please check out our Patreon at our website at occultconfessions.com.
$5 is a lot, but we want it.
But the culture of celebrity was a bit different in the 19th century than it is now. Rich people really hated famous people in many ways. If you were famous for being rich and of good breeding, that was a different story.
Okay, that's what it is now.
Yeah,
I guess you could say.
A lot of our famous people are the rich ones.
Yeah.
But they would be considered gauche in the eyes of the 19th century and been rejected from polite society. Maybe so no one would invite...
Yeah, so like the 0.01% versus the 1%?
The Paris Hiltons and Nicole Richies and Kim Kardashians of the world would never cut muster with the finer set of New York City.
We should go back to that.
Putting yourself before the public eye was, in the eyes of the landed gentry, crass and vulgar. Mm-hmm. Maybe the landed gentry still feel that way, but like I said, I have no way of knowing until you get on that Patreon.
But we could when you donate to our Patreon.
I'll let you know when I've paid off my mortgage. Despite their difference in social status, Elijah Kent Kane persisted. He was, after all, deeply smitten. Their letters to each other, along with those of acquaintances who witnessed their courtship, were published in 1866 as a memoir of the love life of Dr. Kane.
Did somebody post their letters, or they posted them?
Somebody assembled their letters, into a singular book.
Hmm. Why they put them on blast alive? Like that?
I think they probably approved, or somebody.
So these days they don't have to.
Little as she suspected his feelings, he loved her at first sight. Her beauty was of that delicate kind which grows on the heart rather than captivates the sense at a glance.
Kane believed, like Greeley, that Maggie deserved a good education, and he managed to get her mother to let him pay for her to attend Mrs. Turner's boarding school.
Wait, how old was this dude?
He was a bit older than her.
Like a bit? Like 12?
There's no
Somebody
difference.
Find that out for me.
He was born in 1820.
That would make him, 32.
Oh, so...
Oh, he was a bit...
So 12 years older?
A bit older.
Ooh. Yeah, but this was the 19th century. That wasn't...
Yeah, I just wanted to know.
He also had a really thick mustache.
Oh, hell yeah. Right. Oh, can I say that? Oh, we can say hell.
I think we've decided hell is okay. Time. Yeah, we say hell a lot.
We can't do this podcast without saying hell.
Okay, so here's the interesting and fateful thing about Elisha Kent Kane. He was not just a regular Philadelphia gentleman. He was an Arctic explorer.
Oh, hell yes.
Deeply involved in the search for the lost British explorer, Sir John Franklin. Franklin had been charting the Northwest Passage on behalf of the British government, and his disappearance was one of the great mysteries of the Victorian age. Kane was a doctor who had served as a medical officer on the first attempt to locate Franklin from 1850 to 1851. In 1853, Kane organized a second expedition, which he led himself, and left only a month after he'd gotten Maggie into school. The first expedition had found traces of Franklin's encampment, and Kane believed that there were still members of Franklin's party alive somewhere in the Arctic.
Of the 136 picked men of Sir John Franklin in 1846, North Orkney men, Greenland whalers, so many young and hardy constitutions with so much intelligent experience to guide them, I cannot realize that some may not yet be alive.
I am so smitten by this
man. He sounds like my kind of man.
He sounds like a dreamboat back in the day.
Yeah.
Today.
He wasn't alone. The British government had sent several ships. Franklin's wife personally commissioned two ships, and the United States government, along with the financier Henry Grimmel, helped to finance Kane's expeditions. According to Kane's posthumous biographer, William Elder, it totaled up to 25 expeditions of 31 boats, costing in the neighborhood of $4 million.
Back then or right now?
Back then.
Oh, oh my God. That's a lot of money.
It would have been well over $100 million. Yeah.
Holy.
Yeah.
Dear brother and friend, things look so arctic, and the big responsibilities of my undertaking are so crowding around me, that I sit down from that very impulse to give you a brother's letter of confidence. Now that the thing, the dream, has concentrated itself into a grim, practical reality, it is not egotism, but duty, to talk of myself and my plans. I represent other lives and other interests than my own.
2 years passed, with Maggie attending Mrs. Turner's and Kane exploring the Arctic. While Kane was still in reach of civilization, she received letters from him.
Oh, this is so romantic.
But then when he crossed into the Arctic, all she could do was wait nervously for his return. By May of 1855, when no sign of Kane's expedition had appeared, Kane's brother John left on a rescue mission to recover him.
Oh no.
This is so...
I just found the man of my dreams and now I'm losing him.
I want to see this as like a rom-com now.
During the first winter of their expedition, Kane's boat, the Advance, had frozen into the Arctic Sea, and his crew was forced to begin a long trek back to civilization, dragging a small boat across hundreds of miles of ice. He finally returned to New York in October of 1855, and there was some pretty big fanfare about his return.
Well, yeah.
1/6 of his crew had died, and the living were badly hurt by the adventure. Maggie expected him to call on her, but his family interfered. After hearing from one of Kane's friends that his family would not permit a meeting, Kane made a dramatic entrance the next morning in full naval dress.
Oh, that is my boy!
Why can't I have that?
Wow. This is the most
Maybe
beautiful.
One day, Jacob.
I hope.
To please his mother, he had Maggie sign a paper indicating that relations between them were strictly platonic. Regretting having ever made her sign it, he returned the note to her, which she promptly tore up.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right. See, he's a good man.
That's better.
For the next couple of months, Kane worked on his two-volume account of his adventures in the Arctic, and then in summer of 1856, he was invited to London, where he planned to give his account to Franklin's widow in person and receive awards from several scientific societies. Before he left, he called Maggie and her family together and professed that they were husband and wife.
Mm.
Or... at least that was the story Maggie and her family told.
What?
Whether or not they were married in this way, it was clear that Kane loved Maggie and probably would have wanted to marry her. Whether or not they actually did this sort of common law.
Oh no, what is about to happen to this man? Rob.
His health badly compromised by his Arctic adventure and exacerbated by his family drama took a turn for the worse in London, and he sailed to Havana to recover in a warmer climate, but it was no use. Kane died on the 16th of February, 1857.
Well,
I don't want this anymore.
Great,
nope. Yeah.
One more heartbreak for me to carry on me at all times.
Yeah. His family refused to acknowledge Maggie as his widow, perhaps most practically to keep her from inheriting any of his property, but they did end up providing her with a small allowance, which is, I think, an admission that their relationship was genuine.
Well, I guess that's all right, but still, it sucks that he had to die so early like that.
I know.
I knew as soon as I heard his name. He's too great. He's going to die.
Of course he wouldn't live.
But wait, it gets worse.
Oh, no.
In 1858, Maggie converted to Catholicism and took a hiatus from mediumship.
God. It was a hard hit on her.
She said, I'm out.
She was depressed and arguably never recovered from the loss of Dr. Kane, although she did return to the seance table. We know that by the 1880s, 30 years later, she was touring as a medium and had developed pretty severe alcoholism.
Oh my gosh.
The pressures of being a child star are one thing, but the near miss at a happy life, as you all are vocally expressing, with a man she loved, was too much for her to bear. Long after he died, and despite the fact that his family disavowed her, Maggie often went by the name Margaret Fox Kane.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Okay.
This is so depressing.
I'm going to start crying.
Question.
Yeah.
Did she ever try to, like, use her mediumship and, like,
to contact
spiritualism and yeah. to contact
There's
her?
No record of it.
No. She did that it alone. That was probably a personal thing yeah. she did alone.
I'll say from my experience with contemporary mediums that they frequently say they can't, like, work for yeah. themselves. They can only work say, for others.
Plus, I've heard a lot that it's hard to actually, like, pick people yeah. out. Like, it's
yeah,
more like
next
people
to
come to you.
Even if you went to a medium yeah. and she was working, or she or he was working for you, they could only bring you the spirits that made themselves
right.
available. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's extra hard to...
That's so, like, bittersweet that, yeah. like, she has this ability and she
can't
loses
it.
Him yeah. and she can't... Oh, my God.
In 1888, at an event billed as the death blow to spiritualism, Maggie was thrust back into the spotlight one last time. So she had been a sort of grand dame of spiritualism, mm-hmm. albeit with an alcohol problem. Like, she continued to have that kind of celebrity status. But in 1888, she did this thing that made her wildly relevant once more. At the New York Academy of Music, a huge crowd gathered for what promised to be a cataclysmic revelation. Margaret Fox took the stage with her sister Katie looking on approvingly from the balcony. Margaret removed her shoe, and with the confirmation of five doctors, grasping at and observing her foot, she wiggled her toe and made a cracking sound.
I thought you were going to say she had, like, hoofed feet.
Yeah, I know.
She was split foot.
I was about to, like, flip this table.
She had a split foot.
She was split foot.
The woman's big toe sounded like a muffled hammer, but I heard every stroke of the farthest parts of the balcony. That then was the Rochester's rap, whose effect may be compared to the first gun of the revolution heard around the world.
The otherworldly tapping of the spirits had been Maggie's big toe the whole time. Or at least that was the claim.
Oh,
are you
serious?
As what? You were saying that, everything just
yeah.
like made so much. Oh my God.
The scene was chaotic, with skeptics applauding with I told you so grins, and believers literally jumping up and crying out in protest.
Oh, it's not that easy, though.
I don't, yeah. Like, how could know. You crack your toe that loudly and on
command?
Yeah,
apparently
like,
it echoed through the whole theater.
Oh my gosh.
She's gonna have some bad arthritis. Like, I don't...
Yeah.
This particular reporter, Moncure Conway, ascribed Maggie's confession to her Catholic faith. Her guilt had simply overwhelmed her, and nearing her twilight years, she had to fess up.
The whole thing was a ghastly attempt to bury alive the spiritualist loved ones who had been dead, but who had been restored to them by the faith now pronounced by its founders an imposter and delusion.
But, a few months later, Maggie recanted her confession.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And went back on tour giving seances.
But how do you come back from that?
Yeah.
The reason for Maggie's recantation varies according to who you're talking to. Contemporary spiritualists see Maggie's backsliding as genuine remorse for lying and claiming that the taps had been a fraud. The lie was coerced out of her, apparently, by the Catholic Church, which had deceived her away from the truth. Bear in mind, in the 19th century, people really hated Catholics. Skeptics see the recantation as a product of Maggie's alcoholism. She staged the death blow to make money, but after the death blow, nobody wanted to pay her to give seances anymore, and she was destitute, so she went back to support her alcoholism to giving seances. She had to go back on the road, right? So she had to recant. Oops, just kidding. And I think that's what you'll see on Wikipedia today, is the skeptical interpretation. Fun fact.
You want me to look?
No matter who you believe, the one big takeaway from the death blow was that it wasn't a death blow at all, though. Spiritualist mediumship as an international craze had already declined significantly in popularity, dating back to the American Civil War. So really the heyday of spiritualism was the 1850s and 1860s. It's had, you know, surges ever since then, often around, you know, large death events like World War I, but... Mm-hmm. That was it for, like, the height of the popularity of the movement. So this didn't kill that. It was already sort of declined by that point. Mm-hmm. And mediumship as a popular interest has continued through the turn of the century all the way up to the present day. So they brought mediumship into the forefront. It became a part of American culture, woven into the fabric, and you can still go see a psychic medium around the street corner wherever you want, pretty much. Mm-hmm. But this series is about... the supposed supernatural power of a woman's sexuality.
Hell
This is lady magic after all, manifesting in this instance in the phenomena attending the adolescent Katie and Maggie Fox. Whether we want to believe any of the mediumistic feats that they performed under the guidance of their sister, Leah, after leaving for Rochester and then New York, the haunting of the Hydesville house remains an unsolved mystery. Maggie's big toe is not an adequate explanation for the events of 1848. Let's review the evidence. Number one. Former residents of the house, including but not limited to Michael Weekman, who we began our episode with, heard mysterious sounds on the front door and throughout the house without Kate or Maggie even being present. Mm-hmm. They hadn't even moved to New York at that point. And Weekman was just one in a long chain of people who had heard taps in that house. The taps continued even when the sisters were not in the house and when they were as far away as Rochester. So even after they became sort of popular, they didn't have to be around for the taps to sound in the house. One of the first nights, Mom brought them out of the house, and the men investigated without them even present. And there was trace evidence of what may have been human remains in the basement of that house.
Oh, yeah. Ooh. True.
So we have a pretty persuasive case for a legitimately haunted house and a communicating spirit. What's interesting is if Katie and Maggie or Leah really did fabricate their mediumship using this event as a springboard. If that were true, it would show how willing we as a culture are to believe that young women possess otherworldly power, even if it isn't present. Maybe our cultural associations got the better of us this time. But just because we tend to believe that young women are capable of supernatural feats doesn't necessarily mean that that belief is illegitimate. I, for example, tend to believe that American cheese is tasty because I grew up in my mother's deli and the cheese was always good there. But sometimes I come across some waxy processed singles that taste like plastic. That doesn't mean that American cheese is always plastic crap, but it does mean that it can be. You guys see what that has to do with Maggie Fox?
Did you just bring in your problems with processed foods into this podcast?
I can bring that into almost any conversation.
Yeah. So are you stating then that you also agree that you think that she's a fraud?
I am open to the prospect of Maggie not being the best of the mediums that we have to offer. But that doesn't mean that we don't have supernatural women back through the ages. Mm-hmm. It just means that in this case, perhaps we got a kind of plasticky craft single of a woman.
That's what I'm going to start calling women now when I'm like, nah, she's more of a plasticky craft single.
Which is not to take away from the tragedy of her life. Don't get me wrong.
Right. No. I mean, especially when you compare it to, like, which we talk about Enfield later in another episode, won't we?
Look at Enfield,
When you look at, when you would compare it to that, it's like Enfield has, like, substantially, it's the same idea of people are just trying to prove that the kid is a fraud, but it seems the evidence is...
Yeah. That's also a dangerous one. That's not the strongest of cases of poltergeist.
I mean,
Anyway, things to look forward to in the future. Joan of Arc, though, I mean, that's a pretty amazing feat that has supernatural tie-ins. Marie Laveau, some amazing and unusual things happening in a certain space.
Woman.
You know, the Greek maenads tearing bulls apart with their bare hands.
Yeah.
Whoa. In every case, I mean, even if these are natural feats, they're pretty extreme. When we're looking at Maggie, you know, it could be a haunted house that just allowed her to perpetuate.
Mm. Well, the thing is you said that she, her and her sisters were, like, talking to the spirit, but weren't her father was also talking to it, right?
Yeah.
Oh, so they were, okay. That's
I think we definitely have a haunted house situation on our hands. I think that's pretty well documented in the historical evidence. But whether or not Maggie is then a medium or a great toe tapper is open to interpretation.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that Emma Hart and Britton even said, like, that the sister Leah was, like, this great medium.
I wonder, I guess I worry about the culture of celebrity around them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were the originals, so their cultural influence is, you know, beyond consideration. Of course, they were culturally significant.
But did the other two sisters ever recant anything?
Katie clapped alongside, she was up in the balcony when Maggie confessed, and she was approving of this revelation. I would guess that Leah doesn't figure into that particular segment of the story, but she would not have been a fan of any kind of recantation.
Yeah, it sounds like
she was a major figure in American spiritualism.
Yeah.
Maggie never really was, to be honest. She was the begin, you know, she launched it through this event,
But unlike Andrew Jackson Davis, Emma Harding Britton, Cora Scott Richmond, she never developed a practice that allowed her to gain a sort of like respect as a great thinker and channeler of enlightened spirits. They just tapped out these test messages saying your grandma's here and she wants to know that she made you chocolate chip cookies. Cora Scott Richmond's talking about the feminine nature of God, and A.J. Davis has got all these levels of heaven, and you know, these are cool, interesting theories that develop a lot culture of respect around them, but Maggie Fox, it just never happens for. She's a sad person who's depressed throughout most of her life and suffers this great loss and never gets over it. All right, Olivia, bring us on home.
Well, on that note, what do I normally say?
You hereby adjourn.
Thanks. I hereby adjourn and call closed.
You declare it closed.
I declare it closed. Yeah. The secret order of alchemical.
This particular meeting. We were hoping to keep the order together.
Oh.
Please don't shut us down.
Sorry, you leave for a week and everything. Well, I hereby adjourn and declare closed this meeting of the secret order of alchemical actors until such a time as we get together and do it again.
Our voices today included Brandon Walsh, Shannon Landers, and James Kaplangis. We are going to take a dark week next week just as a warning, and then we will be back on the other side of that with the exciting conclusion, three more episodes in our series on Lady Magic. And those will include an episode on Victoria Woodhull, Occultist for President, the traditions of Wicca, and poltergeists. Closing out with poltergeists. You should visit us at www.occultconfessions.com, where you can find a resource page with all the places where we've gotten research from on this episode, and where you can go to click on donate and maybe give a couple bucks to our Patreon. And you can find us on Facebook, also on Twitter at...
Oh, at a podcast occult.
There you go, podcast occult.
And then on Facebook, you just have to look up Occult Confessions and you'll find us. And also on the website, you get to see pictures and fun facts about all of our alchemical actors, so...
But I hate my pictures, so don't look at it.
But skip over Savannah's.
All right, joining us today, we did have Savannah.
Hello, goodbye.
Goodbye. Brianna.
Goodbye.
Jacob. Jacob. Jacob, say goodbye to the people.
Oh, no.
And Olivia... Our Grandmaster.
Bye, guys.
This is Rob. We'll see you next time on Occult Confessions.